You're listening to republicbroadcasting.org, the RBN network. This is the show expansion. I'm Sophia, your host, and we're speaking today with researcher Clifford Carnicom on the subject of aerosol spraying. Clifford, you had said, you had posed the question, what would the implications be of charging electrically the entire atmosphere in which we're living?
Thanks, Sophia. The implications are tremendous. They're absolutely tremendous in terms of when you start thinking about taking a medium that surrounds the entire Earth, okay? This atmosphere, by the way, also, folks, it's much more fragile than I think many of us realize. It's an eggshell around us. It's not like infinite into space, and we have a lot to spare. The atmosphere is a fragile, thin layer around this Earth. Something like three-quarters of the mass of the atmosphere is contained within 7 miles of the ground. It's just amazing to me. You know, the trip you take down to the local grocery store in distance encompasses the vast majority of that which sustains this planet. And, you know, I didn't know originally whether it would, is it actually possible that aircraft could be used to literally alter the atmosphere of the planet? And at the beginning, it seemed like, man, that's a tall order, you know. We've been seeing aircraft fly our whole lives, and we don't see any problems. Is it possible that aircraft could actually alter the very physical constitution of the atmosphere itself? And the answer is yes, it can. It's not as big as we think it is, and it's very delicate. You're talking about a 7-mile layer for the majority of the air that everything depends upon. And I actually did the work at one point to figure out, you know, logistically, is it actually possible to, I mean, logistically, can you carry on an operation that would put enough physical material in the Earth to be able to affect it at the level? And the answer was yes. And you know, the numbers were, again, they're hypothetical to model, but the numbers made sense. It was physically possible to do. And the conclusion that I have made is, sorry, folks, it's been done. It's not a question of could we do it. It's been done. This atmosphere has been physically altered. It is no longer the same as we know it should be. And that's a sad state of affairs to me, because you know you can get looking into particle sizes and the effect on the atmosphere, and you have this gradation, a continuum that can be literally, let's say you imagine just stopping the operation and trying to get life back to normal. You have size ranges, and it's pretty much you can determine directly how long that stuff would stay in the atmosphere, and when you get the material small enough. And they're at the levels that we're talking about. When you start getting in the submicron category, you conceivably can get to the point where those things actually never leave the atmosphere. And that's sad to me to think that that's actually a possibility here. Now, I do believe if the operation would cease, that over a period of several years, you know, the majority of the effect could be compensated for. But it's not really clear that there has not been a permanent change to our planet. And as long as the operations are maintained and sustained in the way that they have been, that is the expectation that we do have an altered planet.
We're going for our break. You're listening to Expansion on republicbroadcasting.org, the RBN network. This is Sophia, your host, and I'm speaking with Clifford Carnicom, aerosol researcher. You just told us, Clifford, that we now have an altered planet. There's pretty much no way around it, it seems to me that a covert global operation has been going on to spray materials in the air that have altered our planet, created a plasma out of our atmosphere in which all of us are living. And this obviously is going to affect life itself.
Yes, thank you very much, Sophia. Let's get back to this topic of implications and applications. Okay, I haven't done this one before, but let's raise this question. How would you like to be inside of a neon light tube? What do you think about that? What if you were in an environment that was fluid, medium, you could walk around, but that ultimately was a energy carrying environment, and you are now, let's say, a potential subject to whatever maneuvers were impressed upon you, whether you cared or not. How would you think about that? So this is the question and image that comes to mind. Of course, it's a matter of degree and scale, and things are not necessarily so obvious. But what I need to do is establish the conceptual basis based upon actual observation and analysis of physical measurable phenomenon that I have been involved in for the last 10 years. That's what I have to try to do, is to bridge these disciplines. And this is a question that comes to mind. What would it mean if you now had the capability and capacity to send energy of some form, let's say, and we can talk about the energy forms later too, but to send energy from one point to another through a medium that it doesn't need any wires. And that medium surrounds the entire Earth. You know, what does that mean? And it's huge. It's huge in terms of its potential applications.
And it's fast as well.
You know, what are weapons? Okay, weapons are a concentration of energy. Are they not usually? There are whole weapon systems that are designed to use the physical properties of a plasma state. You have, you know, directed energy weapon systems. You have systems that try to concentrate this energy into a beam. They have like the equivalent of a stun gun I was reading on. You know, you basically have, this is at the low level with the cops on the, you know, down at ground level, riot control and such. There's weapon systems that you don't touch anybody. You don't send any physical object to anybody. You use an ionized beam to transmit that energy to them and incapacitate them or damage them or kill them or whatever you think is necessary and appropriate to do under the circumstances. When you have the means to transmit and propagate energy from one point to another, you have the means to do things, to inflict things. You also have the means to do beneficial things, but you have the means to send energy, and energy does things. And the whole world is, you know, based upon energy transfer. It's the whole dynamic of life and existence. And the whole universe is a transfer of energy. So if you have developed methods that allow energy to be manipulated, directed, and transferred on a global scale in a way that people no longer even have not only control of, but even knowledge of and awareness of, I'm sorry, but inherent in that is a tremendous level of power and control. And ultimately, that is one of the, and again, I'm not a fearmonger, it's just not my style, but I do deal with reality best I see it. And ultimately, conceptually at least, there is a framework in place that does allow for the control control of the subjects and inhabitants of this planet. I'm sorry, but that's ultimately what it leads to. Now, I've been calling for over 10 years. I've been calling the alarm early in the game. Okay, it's, you know, it's not any time for apologies. The call has been made. Now, I'm only one individual, and fortunately, it does sound like there are more and more people calling themselves to the task. But it's not okay that this has been permitted to happen. I'm a little jaded by now, unfortunately, and I don't have the faith in the institutional systems that I did to rectify the situation at the scale we're talking. You know, I'll commend and compliment people that will do it. I don't have the tolerance or patience for that failure and ineptitude of the political institutions. Petitions have been written. Okay,
right.
Protests have been held.
It suggests that those institutions are maybe even part of this.
Well, I don't make any bones about it. I mean, I view our political systems now and Congress, whatever, is completely complicit in everything that has been allowed to transpire here. There's no... Anybody that tries to play their Republican-Democratic game on this thing is a joke. Just look at the history. You have mutual administrations, and you have complete tolerance and acceptance, denial, refusal, ridicule of those people that raised the seriousness of this issue starting more than 10 years ago and were never given the proper platform or consideration that they deserve. I'm not talking about me. I'm talking about the global citizens that were aware enough to bring this up.
Well, now we have to educate as many of those citizens as we can and somehow induce them to believe that we are not tinfoil hat wearers and that this is really going on. Clifford, would you say that they have created a matrix in which all of us are living? One could even call it a plasma matrix.
Oh, I'd say that's a pretty descriptive use of language. I mean, it's you know, subject to interpretation, but I think that's an interesting phrase. I mean, it has different interpretations and connotations, but you know, on the physical side, the plasma business, it's real, best as I can determine. Okay, it's real. The ionization level of the atmosphere is much, much higher than it should be by my measurements. There is sustained physical measurements and detection of unexplained barium compounds at high levels in the atmosphere. There's other people that are now have been doing this over the years with some of the environmental testing. The physical evidence is there for at a citizen level, I must say. There has never been any formal participation by any supposed authority. You know, our EPA is a joke. Your Environmental Protection Agency is an absolute joke. They never took seriously these claims. I would contend that the actual laws that are in place, the air pollution laws, have been violated for years on end, and they have never been enforced.
Now, I want to discuss the visibility a little bit. The EPA has changed its standard for good visibility. This is one of the apparent modulations of our perception. 30, 40 years ago, good visibility was about 40 miles, and now they say that we have good visibility when we can only see 10 miles.
That's right. Now, Sophie, I don't actually know it with respect to the EPA, but I can talk about it in a more general sense and more with respect to the FAA, I think, than the EPA. But sure, let's talk about visibility a little bit. And again, if we could only remember our experiences and our memories and also combine it with common sense, we don't always need to rely on a, quote, authority figure to supply us with truth and reality. We each stand with that intrinsic to our own self if we only understood that. We don't need to have to believe someone else. But on the visibility thing, okay, you can do it analytically. That's what I've done because I have to, again, have to try to combine these things. But, you know, I used to work at, occasionally, not very often, with substitute. I'd work on the lookout towers and on the fire towers. and that was up in northern Arizona. And that tower had a clear view. And the Grand Canyon was about 110 to 120 miles north of me, where I was, Williams, in Williams, Arizona. And this is not me making this up, okay? This is just a fact. And that is, you can see 100 to 110 to 120 miles in clear air. You just can. Now, on the analytical side, I can show you why this is the case. Okay, there's models, and you can determine what the expected visibility is in relation to clarity of the air or pollution. That can be done. And that figure is on the order of roughly 120 miles when things are good and clean. Now, we know the world's not perfectly clean, but first of all, that's the norm. If the air is clean, that's what you should be seeing. Now, let's go to the 40-mile thing.
We have our break. We'll pick up.
Cascadia Public Radio.
Listening to Expansion on the Republic Broadcasting Network, republicbroadcasting.org. This is Sophia, your host, and I'm speaking today with Clifford Carnicom, aerosol researcher. We were talking about visibility, and we had discussed that on a good day, a clear day, you can see a good 100 miles, or you should be able to.
That's right. Thank you, Sophia. And so if people know where I'm going with this, I'll give you the inline, and I'll tell you a little bit more of how and why I get there. The inline here is that visibility is an expression of two things. It's an expression of pollution, the level of pollution in the atmosphere. And, you know, if nothing else, you know, if we fail to impress the scope of this operation upon the listening audience, I would hope at the very least that there would at least be increased attention and consideration given to the very real existence of increased pollution in our atmosphere that is not adequately addressed. That's about the mildest form that I would be able to approach somebody on this subject with. But if that's the level that you think is appropriate to work at, I hope that you would at least pursue that. Just think about pollution and whether or not it's okay with you. Because not only is visibility an expression of pollution in the atmosphere, but ultimately it's actually an expression of mortality. And it took a little work to do this, but the linkage is that there is a definite known relation of increase in mortality and an increase in the particulate count or the fine count of materials in the atmosphere. This doesn't come from me. This comes from, you know, American Lung Association, has to do with all the smoking studies and this type of thing. But there's a direct known relationship between the increase in fine particles that you breathe and how many of us die. And the fact is that the shorter the distance that you're able to see in your world, the more of us will die. I'm sorry, it's not my job to try and color what we're speaking of with roses. This is just a fact. We have to accept the consequences of what has been permitted to occur.
Well, you use the word permitted, And this is deliberate. It's not that someone is permitting this. It's that someone is doing this. The pollution you're speaking of is not the byproduct of industry or technology. This is a deliberate, ongoing saturation program.
Absolutely true. But the citizenry, I believe, ultimately will bear the responsibility and consequence for controlling the world. I personally believe in the power and control of the individual as opposed to any authority to ultimately control the destiny and fate of our planet. That's just my own opinion.
Sure, so, but if the perceptions of the individual or individuals collectively are controlled and constrained, then those individuals won't even know what's going on.
Absolutely true. I agree with you 100%. And that shows the job before us. And, you know, that was the if we are controlled, if we allow ourselves to be controlled. Absolutely true. I agree with you. But, you know, back on this visibility issue then, let's tie it in at the 40-mile level. We know what should be, both analytically as well as by direct observation, what a good clean air should give to us. Now, we know, unfortunately, that we don't have an ideal world, and so we don't necessarily expect to get the 100 and 120 miles all over the Earth. So let's try to get a little bit more realistic. And here's what happened. I started digging into the visibility reports that were available, and it looks like I did this work. It should be early in the game. Yeah, this was in 2001, so a couple years into the work. I started grabbing the visibility data from the airports and such around the country. Because the FAA has, Federal Aviation Administration has an interest in this, in providing pilot data. So I got the data. And I found something even a little bit interesting at that point that I didn't expect. And that was that the longest distance that was recorded for visibility for pilots, even at the earlier, you know, when it, let's see, my data started back in 1994. But prior to the onset of these operations at the scale that they are in beginning of 1999, close of 98, in 1994, so prior to that, I looked at the visibility data, and I find that the FAA, the maximum distance they report, even back then, is 40 miles. Now, it doesn't mean that the visibility is 40 miles. What it meant was the visibility is 40 miles or greater. Okay? What happened in the past was that if the visibility was 60 miles, 80 miles, it's like the FAA's opinion basically or ruling was, you know what, as long as you can see 40 miles, it covers the ground. It's all we need right now. So we report it to 40 miles, and that's all we need to care about.
Well, we have our break coming up, and we'll return in 3 minutes.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network because you can handle the truth.
You're listening to Expansion on RBN with your host, Sophia. RepublicBroadcasting.org is the URL, and my guest today is Clifford Carnicom, aerosol researcher. So, to continue with the topic of visibility in this matrix that has been created.
Thank you very much, Sophia. You know, as we're doing this, these are things I haven't looked at in a long time, but it's bringing up some very interesting work. But, you know, back to the thing about 40 miles. So what we established there was, you know, in the 90s and such, and around that time, the FAA, the maximum visibility they ever reported for pilots, and, you know, this is a data that's determined for the meteorological services, too. It's all tied in, was 40 miles. They said if you can see 40 miles, you know, that's good enough. You know, VFR or visual flight rules are met, and there won't be an issue. So if pilots know that, that's a good thing, and that's all they need to know. Well, in the research that I did, when obviously the visibility was being affected in a very direct way, I mean, I could see it. That's what caused me to look at this data. What was the data showing on visibility? And I found something that I didn't expect at all, and that was that in my particular case here in Santa Fe, and it ends up extending itself across the nation, best I can tell, it's not just Santa Fe, but this is how it started. And that was, I found that at the very close of 1997, that the standard was changed. And it was dropped from 40 miles to 10 miles. And I remember a part of this happening. I remember being up in Utah one time, and it's like, hey, Utah, this is a place where I know I can see, 100 miles. And I was watching the television news, and I see the weather report scanning on the bottom of the screen, and I see it listing visibility, and it said 10 miles. And I go, this is nuts. I'm in Utah, I know I can at least see 40, 50 miles. I see crap out here in the air, and things aren't looking that great to me, but I know I'm seeing 20, 30, 40 miles. And here on the weather, they're reporting it as 10 miles. And I asked, where is that coming from? And when I looked into it, I found that that standard had been changed. It had been dropped from 40 miles to 10 miles. And it begs the question, why? Why would you drop the standard of visibility? You're talking about flying an airplane, number one. At one level, many applications, but why would you ever drop the level of information that we have about our general environment, knowing that in good conditions we can see 100 to 120 miles? Why would you ever restrain or limit that information to the level of 10 miles and saying, hey, it's not of any consequence, 10 miles or more? Not a problem. As long as we can see 10 miles, that's sufficient knowledge for us. That's absurd to me. It's absolutely absurd, and it remains absurd. And if you look at this, if you ever look at this paper, this one is called Visibility Standards Change. It was done back in 2001. You see the graph, and there's it's nuts as you look at the graph, because you see the visibility being reported at 30, 40 miles, whatever, in 1994. And then you see this sudden discontinuity, this sudden demarcation, where the maximum they ever report is 10 miles. They don't care about anything anymore beyond that. And then you start seeing numbers, 2, 3, 4, 5 miles that you never saw before prior to that. In other words, you have a sudden major drop in the visibility. Right at the very time we're speaking of these operations commencing at this scale. And there's no explanation as to why or what. It's just the way it is, folks. It's just the way it is.
Right. They're telling us, get used to it. This is what you have to work with. I presume you're saying that the visibility is usually only about 10 miles. I mean, are they reflecting an actual reality or...
Well, if you look at this graph of the data, you don't know what's happening above 10. Mm-hmm. But now the data is no longer available to you. All you can tell is now you have numerous days occurring beneath lower than 10 miles that you never had before, which, of course, is in accord with the experience. That's what motivated this. I got to the situation where, I'm driving to Albuquerque, New Mexico, 60 miles south of me. There's a huge mountain range. And the mountain range is on the order of 5 miles away or even less sometimes. There's a couple mountain ranges down here. And it got to where the darn mountain was, 2 or 3 miles from me, and I could not even see the mountain clearly, the ground. I spend a lot of time outside, and I keep track of this kind of stuff. And it got to where you didn't even have clarity to see a major landform a few miles in front of your face.
And no one's questioning it.
And this is how absurd it had become over time. And this is what led to this work. And I'm looking at this other graph since we brought it up on this business of mortality. I wrote a paper in 2004 called Mortality versus Visibility. And this was sort of an interesting linkage, but it was to follow through that statement about, since I know that an increase in particulate count will cause an increase in mortality, the question in my mind was how much? And I looked at that problem, and I created a model. Again, models are always an attempt to represent reality. There's nothing sacred about them, but you do your best to create the models that mirror reality. And I think this model is actually quite realistic and reasonable from what I can see. And if we look at that chart, we know what this thing, I haven't looked at this in years, but what this model came up with was that when the visibility drops down to 10 miles, it looks like it's roughly causing an 8% increase in mortality. You know, the numbers on this are basically if it's 60 miles, if you can see 60 miles, it has essentially no effect on mortality. You get to 10 miles, it causes an increase in mortality on the order of 8%. And then when you drop down to 3 miles in that area, you're getting an increase in mortality of up to roughly 20%. So, you know, these are fairly dramatic numbers when you think about them, because the fact is you can look at that chart I was just talking to you about on the visibility, the actual data that comes in from Santa Fe, New Mexico, or anywhere else as far as you want to look at it. And I'm sorry, you will see numerous days where that visibility was reported at being less than 10 miles. Suddenly, just, you know, sharp line.
Well, Clifford, you've made a very important connection. I didn't see it this way before, but this is a good way to explain and prove to people the real danger of what's occurring, that these mortality rates, if the visibility is only 10 miles, you have an 8% increase. If it's 3 miles, as little as 3 miles, you have a 20% increase in mortality. This suggests some kind of global depopulation effort, even.
Well, you know, this is at the simplest and most elementary level of impact upon human health and existence. And that is the mechanical ingestion. We're not even really talking about what's in them, what their composition is chemically, whether there are any biological aspects. You know, that's another whole tale that we may or may not be able to get into. But we're speaking now at the most elementary, physical, mechanical level, and that is just breathing, let's say, foreign material. Boy, that's a nice way of saying it. Pollution, just breathing physically, mechanical, physical objects of a certain size will have its damaging effect upon the existence of human life. Now, I can simply say, start with that one, folks. Start with that one, because this is what the data says. I'm not out to make anything up. I don't need to make anything up. I don't want to make anything up.
No, this is a very clear, very transparent way of framing it. Just start with the mechanics. Just start with the obvious, is what you're saying. So I don't think we'll be able to get into the biological aspects of this, but I hope that I can interview you another time for that.
Sure, we can carry on sometime.
Now, Clifford, I want to just introduce into this show the foundation that you have begun, because I think people should be aware of that. They can help, can they not?
Yes, Sophie, I appreciate that very much. I'll tell you the status and situation in an honest and fair way, and then we'll see where we can go. Let's be blunt about it, and that is the institute does not exist at this point. Let's say I'm working on it. Okay. I am trying to create a institute under my name that will hopefully serve a broader mission. Of course, it's related to this research, but the broader mission, when that's read, will be seen to basically try to pave the way towards approaching these types of problems in the future, hopefully after I'm gone as well. And the basic issue here, you know, is the lack of protection of the welfare of the citizens and the health of this planet, and in a way that the citizens can no longer, let's say, put a stop to, even if they care. They try. Citizens try to do their work. and they try to holler, and they try to protest all through the right channels. They do all the things they're supposed to do. And they write their petitions, and they call their senators, and they call their congressmen. And nothing happens, and they're dismissed, and they're ridiculed. And they're never given the attention that they deserve. That's not okay with me. It's not okay now, and it won't be okay with me 100 years from now or whenever. And so, yes, I would like to start something. My reality now is that I have almost no time, literally no time for research. We're talking maybe an hour or two a week. So I have to try to choose where I'm going to put it. And, yes, I do have a hope and an ambition of starting a institute that will, let's say, put that seed in place. I don't know if it's going to come to pass yet or not. I can only say I'm working on it. If people want to, they have to be patient, I guess. And the first thing to do is see if we can get this off the ground in a formal sense. I have no resources behind me, and the folks that I'm working with don't particularly have any resources either.
Now, but, Clifford, would you like, in your ideal world, would you like to be able to do this research full-time?
Oh, how would we say that? I guess, how would I say that? This is a mixed answer. Mixed answer is, yes, I would do more if I could. That's true. But the fact is, I'd be chartering 1,000 people of things that I think need to be done and should have been done years ago. So no matter what, even if I had the complete latitude to do anything and everything that I thought I could, I can't begin a fraction to cover a fraction of what needs to be done and what should have been done for the last 10 years. So the best that I can offer, and that's hopefully where the direction of the Institute is to try to chart out a course that people might take if they care about this. I wouldn't be able to accomplish a fraction of what needs to be done. But, yes, maybe I would do more, but I'm looking at a much bigger scale in terms of what needs to be done. And I don't know that I can accomplish it. I just know that I have a duty to choose to put my time in the best way that I can. And since it's so limited now, I'm choosing to try to see if I can extend it beyond myself. And people will have to watch to see if that particular organization comes to pass. But I can also say there's no reason to limit it or wait on me, folks.
No, that's true. But I just wanted to put it out there so people would be aware of it. Now, I want to ask you another question. You said that if this operation were stopped somehow and the spraying didn't continue, that the atmosphere could recover its health, shall we say, and be kind of de-plasmaized, to make up a word. But Clifford, here's my question. The stuff that's being sprayed is noxious. It's toxic, heavy metals and so forth. We haven't gone into the particulars, but you have done that on your website and in other shows. Now, all that is falling down on the earth, is it not? Isn't it packing itself into the soil and life forms? How could that be reversed?
Absolutely right is all I would say for what you're saying. What we're speaking of earlier, simply speaking of, you know, the earth has a capacity to heal also to some degree, right? Unfortunately, it does, and we do have the capacity to heal. So the level we were speaking of, I was speaking only of the atmosphere, that, yes, we could expect gradual improvement. But the point you're making is exactly the case. And let's just open that up right now. What we're talking about is not just the atmosphere. This is just where the issue starts. But the real impact is exactly what Sophia is saying, okay, and that is upon the planet. Yes, if something falls down from the air down, it's expected to have an impact on the planet, not just the air. You'll see a whole set of work I did in relation to soil studies and this type of thing. You know, we have these major tracts of land where, forests are just being wiped out. And so I did quite a bit of work at some period on examining the role of increased salts in the soil and what that might do to our vegetation. You know, I don't want to make it sound worse than it is, but it's exactly what Sophia is saying. The impact is upon the planet. At the conference in Los Angeles I was at, I think I made the point about the decline in the ocean species, all species of life in the oceans. It was down, like, I think the number was, 25% or something? In the last, it may have been even more dramatic than this. I'd have to dig it up. But in the last 10 years, there has been a dramatic reduction. Dramatic reduction in the actual life in the oceans. To where it, literally, one could very conceivably think that this could impact the survival of the planet. That's not an exaggeration. The number was huge.
The ocean water, Clifford, I'm in it almost every day. It has become more and more cloudy over the years. We used to have clear visibility to the bottom, 15 feet, 20 feet down, every single day just about 20 years ago, unless the water was turgid and sand was being, and algae were being kind of churned up by surf and swell. Today, you almost never, ever, ever see the bottom. So we're going off for our break, but we'll be back for our last little bit with Clifford Carnicon. You're listening to Expansion on RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network. This is Sophia, your host, and I am sorry to say that I'm finishing up today a very fascinating 2 hours with Clifford Carnicon. Clifford, I wanted to bring up the incremental nature of this operation. It has been occurring quite obviously to some of us, but very incrementally over a long period of time, 10 years or so, you might say, and people haven't noticed because it's been incremental. So we need to get them to see it now, to compare what they're seeing today with what they saw as a child in the very physical nature of the world.
If you have a 10-year-old child right now, they know of nothing else. Normal is relative to the time reference in which we live. The 10-year-old child, this is now their normal world. It calls upon us, that those of us that have a longer experience base, those of us who have lived longer, to share and relate our understanding of this world to those that carry on. That's our job. And it's not okay, in my mind, to let something go, and especially when we're talking about our home. You know, I found this article on the BBC, on this oceanographic stuff, and indeed, it's on the order of 25 to 30% reduction. It's just astounding. 25 to 30% reduction of ocean birds, as well as land-based birds, since the mid-1990s. And this comes from, this is the Zoological Society of London. This is not Clifford again. Clifford doesn't need to make things up. This is Zoological Society of London with a BBC article. You're talking about 25 to 30% reduction of major life forms in the past 10 to 15 years. It's astounding, the scope and scale of what we're speaking of.
Yeah, and we have to somehow invite people to appreciate this. They're so distracted. They're so, many people are on an automatic pilot in their lives, and I don't know how they can be made to appreciate what's happening in even the natural world, as you're pointing out, when they don't have a connection with the natural world. They're living in urban environments, doing urban-style things.
Yes, and ultimately we do all have a connection to a natural world, however that comes to us. You know, eventually we all do.
Yes.
You know, here's a statement. I know you're running out of time, but on the same article, I see this generalized statement I hadn't seen before. This guy, it must be the head of the World Wildlife Fund, I guess. Here's a statement. Reduce biodiversity means millions of people face a future where food supplies are more vulnerable to pests and disease, and where water is an irregular or short supply. Okay. This is the picture that's being painted, I'm sorry to say. And again, I'm not a gloom and doom person. I mean, why do I do this for 10 years? It's because I have hope in the human spirit to do that which is known to be the right thing.
Well, yes, and you're motivated by a principle that we all need to adopt and act on. So, Clifford, I thank you so much for this very wonderful 2 hours of your time.
I thank you very much, Sophia. Thanks for the opportunity. I'm glad we were able to finally get our time squared away here.
Yes.
I'll help any way that I can.
Thank you. I would love to invite you on again then.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah, thanks, Sophia.
Bye.